This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
People are asking for a clear cut from the old system, and which means that the current leadership team has to leave office and that there should be some kind of temporary arrangement of new faces, new leaders, and so on.
That's Azzedine Laïchi, an Algerian-American professor of Middle East and African Affairs, expressing his thoughts on what Algerians are hoping for. Details coming up. Also, a spokesman for Ethiopian Airlines says the pilot of the plane that crashed Sunday reported problems controlling the jet. And heavy rains and flooding in northern Mozambique have killed at least 66 people. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, after initial celebration over President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's pledge not to seek re-election, thousands of Algerian students and some lecturers held a new protest today in the Algerian capital. They accused the ailing leader of using tricks to prolong his two-decade rule. U.S. State Department spokesperson Robert Palladino says the United States supports the right of Algerians to free and fair elections and that it is closely monitoring reports that elections have been postponed. Algerian opposition figures are meeting today to respond to Bouteflika's unclear roadmap. Azzedine Laïchi, an Algerian-American professor of Middle East and African Affairs at St. John's University in New York, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the volatile situation.
People did not want to fall for another manipulation as it happened in the past, promises of change and all that, while the rules of the game, meaning the system, remains the same. So now people are asking for a clear cut from the old system, and which means that the current leadership team has to leave office and that there should be some kind of temporary arrangement of new faces, new leaders, and so on to organize the transition. And of course, all this must have, I assume, the blessing of the military, which is the only institution that is really standing and which has the power to move the country one way or another.
The U.S. State Department spokesperson Robert Palladino said the United States supports the right of Algerians to free and fair elections, and the United States is closely monitoring reports that Algeria's elections have been postponed. Would the United States pressure the Algerian government to respect the people's will?
It's difficult to make sense of this because the United States has taken different positions when people were rallying against their rulers, as it happened during the so-called Arab Spring. So the Algerians are not going to be moved by this. It is a small signal to the people who are in leadership position in Algeria to try to, in a way, make concessions, but not necessarily shake the boat entirely, because the U.S. has a great interest in stability in Algeria, as we know that, for economic reasons and for security reasons. So they are just trying to appear to be on the right side of history, which means on the right side of people, but without really pressuring too much the system, just the way the French have been doing.
Algerian opposition figures are meeting today to respond to Bouteflika's unclear roadmap. His key rival, Ali Benflis, former prime minister, said the president was prolonging his fourth mandate. Would the popular protest and a unified opposition force a real change in Algeria?
I think it's going to take a while, but the pressure might hopefully, peacefully lead to good reasoning on the part of those who are in power today to give in, make more concessions for a transition that will be an actual break from the past. People are sick and tired of the system that has ruled Algeria since 1962, and they're also very worried about, you know, tricks like this one's here, like the transition being managed by the government itself. You know, they don't want that. They want the transition to be managed by entirely new crew. and which will set up new rules, a new constitution and all that, without being chaperoned by the current people who are in power, be it Bouteflika or anybody else. So I think that the push from the street is going to continue, is going to go on. And my hope is that it remains peaceful and that those in power, the actual power holders behind the scene, will yield. Otherwise, if the boat really rocks hard, everybody loses.
That was Azzedine Laichi, an Algerian-American professor, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about the volatile situation in Algeria. The U.S. State Department today painted a grim picture of abuses in several countries, including Venezuela, Iran, and China, in its country reports on human rights practices for 2018. One bright spot in the annual report was Ethiopia. The report says the election by Abiy Ahmed as prime minister last year brought significant improvements in human rights there. Despite the new peace agreement in South Sudan, the annual report indicates no significant improvement there, with abuses committed by fighters from all sides of the conflict. And in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the State Department says that last year, government security forces and rebel groups continued to commit abuses such as killing and torture, primarily in the east and central Kasai region. Congress requires that the State Department issue a global look at human rights each year. The full report with the country-by-country breakdown is available at www.state.gov. A severe drought in Africa, now in its seventh year, threatens widespread famine. Experts cite several causes for the lack of rainfall, including climate change and increasingly harsh El Niño fluctuations. For more on what the drought means to East African farmers and those who depend on them, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with New York University Environmental Studies Professor Sonali McDermott.
It could mean many things. One, if you're taking away production from the region, that's going to be a deficit in your income as a household and even regionally, which means that you're going to have less money to buy supplies for your crops if you're going to be planting anything else. Or it might mean that you don't have enough money to go and purchase food at the local markets, or perhaps you don't have enough money for healthcare, or you don't have enough money to send your kids to school. The longer the drought happens, the more all of these other household obligations become difficult.
And what are some solutions to these challenges in the short and middle term?
Some of that can be solved with good and very mindful aid, so bringing in food supplies to the region. But one of the fears that we have is that that food might not get distributed to everybody who needs it at the time that they need it. And so we also need to think about how to make farmers a bit more resilient in the face of what might be ongoing droughts into the future.
What are some ways that farmer resilience can be promoted, given the near certainty that the number of extreme droughts is likely to grow as climate change worsens?
So some of these solutions rely on expanding farmers' access to financial tools and markets outside of agriculture. Some really important things moving into the future are going to be the planting of drought-tolerant varieties or heat-tolerant varieties of crops that don't require as much water to grow. So I think an important part of this is going to be enabling local researchers and organizations to improve and develop varieties of crops. This could mean pulses or sorghum or coarse grains. So seed development is going to be one part of this. Providing water for irrigation, that's not possible everywhere, but trying to see if irrigation systems can be expanded in these regions is also going to be part of the solution as well, too.
And of course, land management is a big part of it too, right?
Yes, absolutely. Making sure that your soils and your whole agroecosystem can hold on to both the nutrients and water as much as possible. And that might mean growing a diversity of crops, and a lot of these farmers do already, but making sure that that's very deliberate and making sure that you're building soil health is also going to be really important for these regions moving forward.
Are you reasonably optimistic that these resiliency strategies will be put in place, or are we just looking at more extreme drought and starvation in East Africa?
I think we're better equipped now than we were, say, back in the 80s and 70s. I'm not going to deny at all that climate change and the increasing level of climate change is going to really make this challenging. But there's a lot more brain power working on this problem as well, both from within the African continent and outside. We also know now that farmers derive a lot of their household security from off-farm activities. This could mean their kids going into local cities and sending money back, or they're doing off-farm labor. These are also opportunities to make sure that even in times where they're not yielding properly due to drought, it's important that the government steps in, or that there's other safety nets, both either market-driven or government-driven, that farmers can access. It's not just going to be the seed that saves a farmer from drought. It's not just going to be irrigation. It's not just going to be remittances from the city. It's going to be a combination of all of those things together that make these communities more resilient. And that means that all the experts, your economists, your social scientists, your crop scientists, your climate scientists, the farmers groups, all of these people need to come together to make sure that these solutions are in place, because this is a multi-factor problem. It's not just the climate that causes this. And I think now that we're recognizing that, we're going to be much better equipped to tackle it, even in a changing climate.
That was environmental studies professor Sonali McDermott of New York University speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Sixteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A spokesman for Ethiopian Airlines says the pilot of the plane that crashed Sunday, killing 157 people, reported problems controlling the jet. Investigators are studying wreckage and flight recorders to find out what caused the Boeing 737 MAX 8 to crash. A growing list of countries have grounded that model of plane amid safety concerns. Ethiopian Airlines spokesman Asrat Bagasho told Agence France-Presse that the company had decided to send the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder to Europe for examination. The so-called black boxes are designed to preserve information about a flight in the event of a crash. He said Ethiopia was not able to recover data from the devices, noting that both devices have sustained damage. Boeing says the 737 MAX 8 is safe. U.S. federal aviation officials say there is no reason to ground the aircraft at this time. U.S. aviation officials are among those investigating the crash site near Addis Ababa. Ethiopian Airlines said the pilot had difficulties before the plane plunged to the ground. Data from a Boeing 737 MAX 8 operated by Indonesia's Lion Air, which crashed in October, showed that the pilots also struggled with controlling the plane. Boeing has been criticized for failing to give pilots enough information about the plane's anti-stalling technology that could cause problems under some flying conditions. Another Ethiopian Airlines spokesman told the AFP that the company's pilot had been trained. On Sunday, Ethiopian Airlines chief said the pilot, 29-year-old Captain Yared Mulugeta Getacho, was an experienced pilot. Participants at a major United Nations meeting on the environment are challenging governments around the world to initiate policy changes to tackle a growing pollution crisis. The conference has attracted more than 4,700 delegates from across the globe, including environment ministers, scientists, and environmental campaigners. On the sidelines of the meeting at the UN Environment Headquarters in Nairobi, UN officials and the European Union shared insights today about a major global initiative dubbed Switch to Green that supports governments in their transition to green economies. Professor Kwabena Fermipong Boteng is Ghana's Minister of Environment, Science, Technology and Innovation. VOA's Ruben Chama asked him to explain what the initiative is all about.
Switch Africa Green is a program that is helping Africa to adopt the green economy. process where we bring the SMEs together and adopt innovative ways of using local materials and also exchanging byproducts from one area to the other. For example, what is waste in an SME, a company, can be a raw material that is used by another company. And in the production of power, in the management of electronic and hazardous waste, these are all areas where one can employ the green principles. So this has been helpful in Ghana. For example, in the management of electronic waste, we had a situation where young men and women were burning the plastic coverings of cables, were burning mobile phones, refrigerators, just to remove a few valuable items according to them, let's say copper and silver from them. The rest is dumped and it becomes waste. So the green, switch green, is finding a way of stripping the covering of the cables and using those plastics to create something else. For example, shoes, tables, water hose, and so on. When we go to the, say, the fish industry, they process the good parts of the fish and throw the rest away. Now, that waste can be used by another company to produce fish meal for the fish industry and also to produce omega-3 fatty acids and some of these things. So these are examples of what the Green Africa is all about.
Could you share with us the partnership between the European Commission and Africa?
Collaboration started even with the enactment of the laws. To do this, you need laws legislation. And we had a lot of help from the European Union in preparing the laws. For example, the law that regulates the management of electronic waste in Ghana was came to being because of the help that we received from the European Union. And we also read technical assistance and financing some of the SMEs. So these are areas where we collaborate with the European Union. Yeah.
And finally, what are your takeaways from this conference? And what is your message to people around Africa?
Yeah, we need to scale up our efforts, find more collaboration with the European Union and the North and also in the South, so that we can scale up our efforts in broadening the scope of the work that we are doing with the green economy.
Any takeaways from this conference?
Takeaways, what we can see is that we are on the right path, looking at what is happening around us in the South, in the North, and the collaboration. I think that a lot of countries are adopting it, not only countries in the South, but in the North as well. Even with the e-waste and so on, there are a lot of countries in Europe, European Union, that are taking the management of hazardous waste seriously. And so we are not alone.
That was Professor Kwabena Frimpong-Boateng, Ghana's Minister of Environment, Science, Technology and Innovation, speaking to VOA's Ruben Chama in Nairobi. Rescuers are searching for survivors after a building of several stories containing a school collapsed in Lagos, Nigeria. As many as 100 young children are feared to be trapped inside. The governor of Lagos State, Akunwumi Ambodi, said 25 people have been rescued, but he also admitted there were an unspecified number of deaths. Ambodi said the school was set up illegally and that buildings in the area were being tested for structural strength. The building stood in the Itafaji area of Lagos Island, the original center of the city. The Lagos Emergency Management Agency said at least 10 people have been rescued alive. Rescuers are using earth-moving equipment and their bare hands to probe the remains of the building, which is now a pile of concrete and metal. Building collapses are common in Nigeria, where building rules are not enforced and materials are often too of poor quality. In 2016, more than 100 people died in the collapse of a church in the country's southeast. In the same year, at least 30 people died in Lagos when a five-story building crumbled. The recent arrest of Cameroon's former defense minister on corruption charges has sparked a debate. Is the government actually trying to stamp out corruption or just cracking down on anyone it sees as a challenger to longtime President Paul Biya? Moki Edwin Kensaka reports from Yaounde.
The arrests of former Defense Minister Edgar Aleme Bengo, his wife and three of his close collaborators, is dominating public debate in the Central African state. Political analyst Eugene Mbida says Mbengo was seen by many as an important figure.
Monsieur Edgar Aleme Bengo a longtemps été présenté comme celui-là.
He says after occupying several strategic positions, including the director of President Paul Biya's cabinet, police chief, minister of transport and defense minister, who was instrumental in arresting people considered as opponents of Biya, Mbengo was widely viewed by a vast majority of Cameroonians as the emblematic future president. Mbengo joined at least 24 former government officials who have been arrested and imprisoned in Cameroon over the past 10 years, including a former prime minister, several ex-ministers, and heads of state-owned corporations. The charges against Mbengo are still to be made public, although corruption is said to be the cause of his arrests. The other officials were arrested on embezzlement charges. Most have said they are political prisoners and are suffering for raising their voices against Biya's 37-year stay in power. Former Health Minister Uben Olangena Awonu, in his book titled Mensonges d'État, or Lies of the State, says he and other detainees are prisoners of conscience. Jacques Mfege of the Yaoundé-based Center for the Promotion of Good Governance says officials should be forced to declare their assets before taking office.
L'opération Épervier souffre déjà de quelques pesanteurs au départ. Premier pesanteur, c'est.
He says that is the only way citizens can be convinced that people who are arrested actually stole from the public purse. He says Cameroon should also upgrade the audit bench of the Supreme Court to an autonomous court that investigates financial crimes. The government has always denied that Biya persecutes those who oppose him and insists that it fights only corruption. It says the country has lost about $1.5 billion in stolen funds over the past decade and that the anti-corruption body recovered about $260 million of that money last year. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Next, stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an exclusive interview with the Vice President of Malawi, Saulos Chilema. The Malayan politician and VOA's Shaka Sali discuss democracy and the upcoming elections. An in-depth look at Malawi's future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.